Okay, so I've been a drug dealer. I've been an alcoholic. I've been an addict. I've been in jail. I've stolen cars. I've had affairs. I ran away from home. I've been homophobic. I've been racist. I've been sexist, disrespected my parents. I've dropped out of school. And still, people say to me, "You're so inspirational." All right, so I took a stand-up comedy course in the fall. Stand-up comedy, right? That's the joke, I guess. But. And that was my opening joke. We all had to do 5 minutes at Yuck Yucks. And it just kind of occurred to me that this was an interesting form of humor, because in a way it pointed out to me that it's funny because nobody expects it. Nobody may look at me and expect that. I mean, all those things I said are true. You know, it's not just written to be a joke. I mean, I look back on my life and I came from a place of some pretty negative attitudes and behaviors. And yet, you know, somebody that doesn't even know you might say, "Well, you're so inspiring just because I have a disability that I live with." I assume that's the joke. But I thought it was interesting in the context of radical inclusion. And I wonder if sometimes people with disabilities are generally thought of as relatively passive, nice people, you know, that aren't really that radical or capable of the radical thoughts that we may have. I think that issue of first impressions that can often be wrong, and how we as individuals and communities respond to that dissonance, reflects our ability and willingness to adapt, grow, accept, and celebrate, not just tolerate, diversity and impermanence. Of course, that idea of impermanence, I'm sure you've probably discussed here, about learning to accept impermanence, that everything is always evolving, nothing's static. So it's a hard concept to kind of accept when you're feeling down and you're feeling sad and lonely and all those things. I think as we get, fortunately, do get older, we find it a bit easier to deal with that issue. Anyway, thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Gene, and everybody else for being here. I don't normally give talks to groups of people, but I think with these kinds of issues, I'm happy to try to throw something together and continue the conversations, you know, with larger groups of people. Gene and I are, and Jack, in fact, and David, and Denise, we're all part of a community. I would say, you know, part of a persons with disability community that get together regularly and fortunately have these kind of conversations and share a pretty deep intimacy with each other. And I have this feeling that without that, I probably wouldn't even be here today in terms of still being alive, because I needed that to get me through all these changes in my life. I also think that life is relatively empty and antiseptic without it. So it's really kind of the focus of my talk today is along the line of intimacy and sexuality, if you like. And to be honest, I didn't know anything about radical inclusion. I didn't know it was a thing when I talked to Deborah. And I looked it up and I thought that it was sort of one of the core principles of Burning Man. It's deeply embedded in a lot of religious ideologies, and there's been a lot written about it. And there's also been a fair amount written about it from the perspective of people that have so-called been radically included, but didn't feel they were included. They felt they were just present, but not really part of what was going on. Even a Burning Man, that they would create inclusive tents and camps, and people would be there, but nobody would talk to them. So there can be a superficiality about that. So in talking to Deborah at first, I thought, well, what do I do that might be considered radical? I mean, in some ways, everything I do, depending on your perspective. But I thought about, you know, drumming, comedy, acting, sailing, even having a career might be considered radical by some people. Having relationships and sex probably is the main one, though. I think that's always interesting to people talking about sex. So let's go with sex. Not experientially right now, but we'll just have a... So I thought it's going to be somewhat of a personal story, but let me take you back a few years. So I was injured in 1975 in a diving accident at Wreck Beach. And I sustained a spinal cord injury at the cervical 5-6 level, which is kind of mid-neck. And it's considered a complete injury. So I've had no return of function, either sensation or voluntary movement. So, of course, I was really didn't know anything about disability. I thought this would be something I'd recover from, like a broken bone. Before that, I had left home at age 17. I'm going to try to follow the script. I don't normally do that. This is my problem. I always go off script. Then I get lost, so I'll follow it. But excuse me for reading once in a while. So as I said, I was 19. I'd left home when I was 17 after dropping out of high school, which I rarely attended anyways. I drove out to Vancouver from Kingston, Ontario with my best friend, Reg. I got my fair share of trouble in my teenage years and experimented a lot with drugs, alcohol, crime, and assorted forms of delinquency. I think that my parents knew that I needed a major shift in my life, and they didn't do much to dissuade me from leaving home, to be honest. Ironically enough, my father is actually a specialist in rehab medicine. I didn't really pay much attention to what he did. I knew that he was a doctor, but I didn't really know, you know, the kind of injuries that he dealt with, anything like that. But I soon found out what his career was all about. I had enjoyed my time in Vancouver for those 2 years, living freely, communally, continuing to use drugs, and have a variety of sexual relations. Excuse me, you may notice I have a little throat issue today, so I'm going to be lubricating. That's off topic, though. After my injury and 3 months in acute care, I returned to Kingston for rehabilitation, partly to get away from a complicated three-way relationship I was in. My life had turned upside down, although really the only ambition I had at that time was to be a rock drummer in a touring band or to be a long-distance truck driver and possibly finish high school eventually. I considered suicide a number of times and couldn't imagine living my life with a significant disability. Although I held out hope for a number of years that something would change, it never did, and it soon became apparent that this was going to be my life. It wasn't so much that I wanted to die, I just didn't want to live the life that I had been given. And I just felt trapped in this. There was nothing I could do about it. There was no different choice or action I could take. It was, and I didn't know anything. I mean, I'm 19 years old. I wasn't that deep in terms of my thoughts. I was pretty introspective. But, the idea of impermanence and acceptance and concepts that I learned later came much later, actually. I mean, it still amazes me now that, I mean, it's been 42 years now since I was injured. And, you know, I often say now if people ask me if I had the choice to change it, I say no. I wouldn't want to give up everything that I've experienced in those 42 years. It's been quite an amazing ride. I don't think there's any life you can be given that's not going to have ups and downs in it, for sure. And this has turned out to have a lot of ups for me. I actually thought that the injury saved my life because almost immediately, I was lying on the beach and I couldn't move anything. I'd actually almost drowned. My girlfriend sort of dove in and they just yanked me out by the arms. I didn't, you know, nobody knew that I had spinal cord injury or really how to deal with that. I mean, of course, now you'd stabilize, you make sure the person doesn't move and all that, but we didn't know what we were doing. So fortunately for me, I had some background in relationships, sex, flirting, and that sort of thing. And I soon found myself getting involved in various relationships, even while in hospital, although they were mainly affairs. Eventually, I met a woman that was 8 years older than me, and she certainly had more maturity and experience and insight and communication skills than I was used to. And we're still great friends today. And I honestly don't know if I could have got through it without her kind of support, without that kind of intimacy in my life. When I got out of hospital and returned to the community on a full-time basis, I really began to notice that people looked at me differently and treated me differently. And it was very subtle sometimes, but it's something that I had never noticed before, being able-bodied. And I still notice it today. It's quite profound and it's very nuanced at times. But at that age, it was pretty abrupt. I mean, I had friends that said they didn't want to see me anymore. They just couldn't. It was too uncomfortable for them to see me like this. And at that point, I was relatively, you know, I didn't look as disabled, I guess, as I do now. I was 19. I was still sort of sitting straight, upright. I had long hair and a beard and, you know, kind of still fit in that way. But it was just the presence of me that made some people uncomfortable. And that was really hard to take. Let me just find my spot here. So when I went back to school as a mature student at Queen's University and eventually got my first degree. I was extremely self-conscious and anxious about my appearance and my ability to fit in. And I always tried to look as normal as I could, whatever that is. I don't want to belabor this, but I guess my point is, in terms of the radical inclusion concept, that I think we have to look at it from two sides, both the personal and the interpersonal. When we face significant changes in our personal lives, our health, our relationships, our status, often our inclination is to deny it, get angry, reject it, try to change it, or blame it on others. I acquired my disability with a belief and a value system that labeled people with disabilities as mentally dysfunctional, broken, asexual, isolated, second class, and poor. It was hard for me not to label myself in the same way. And when I experienced any form of discrimination, it reinforced my beliefs and pushed me back into drugs and avoidance and depression. Of course, integration and acceptance is not a short process, and it's one that continues throughout my life, especially as I'm getting older and facing new challenges. Given that my life at that time of injury, as I said, age 19, was mainly centered around physical experiences. Issues around my sexuality were the hardest to integrate. My struggles with my sexuality were deeply embedded in my male identity. How I defined sex, i.e. only intercourse counts, and gender roles I learned at a young age. Even though I found much more satisfying physical sexual gratification after my injury through experimentation and patience, I still felt that somehow I wasn't normal. I think that experimentation and patience is probably not giving that as much as it's worth. I was very fortunate to be injured in 1975 and to be in Vancouver. The spinal cord, yeah. Well, no, that's okay. the spine unit had actually just opened. I was actually their first acute patient. There were a couple other people there. They'd been flowing in from the Okanagan and so forth. And Dr. George Zaz, I don't know if that name's familiar to anyone, but he was and still is in some respects, even though he's retired. But he kind of wrote the book on sexual health and education and was starting his practice. And he actually worked within the spine unit. And we did a lot of work together. And he worked with as I said, I was kind of in a complicated relationship at the time, but he did some work with one of my girlfriends and me together and things that we could try out that I would never have considered in a million years. I thought my sex life was completely over because I did think of it as, well, it's intercourse. I could still have intercourse, but I couldn't feel it. And I couldn't ejaculate. I hope this is okay, not too graphic stuff, but the reality is that was the truth. So I would feel like motivated, but in the end I'd feel very sad by the experience because I wasn't able to do what I used to do, and I really missed that. And it's, to be honest, it's still true today. I don't think that I've 100% let go all the time. But the gratification comes from knowing that if you can kind of let go that what you want, that you used to have. We have these things we call eargasms, headgasms, that when you lose sensation in one area, the sensation in another part of your body that you do feel tends to be heightened and can be utilized. Let's just put it that way. Okay, so as years went by, I met a number of people that had never had any meaningful intimacy, especially on a physical or sexual level, their whole lives. The reasons for this are numerous, but the obvious ones would include institutionalization, being born with a disability and being sheltered your whole life, being kept separate from normal social interaction, and of course, societal attitudes. That doesn't mean that the desire is not there. And the frustrations and longing and pain caused by this run very deep for many people. This is not to say that all people with disability have this issue, by any means. About 15 years ago, after meeting a 12-year-old boy who had sustained a spinal cord injury while playing hockey. Myself and a few others decided it was time to try to do something. What was a young boy or girl who hadn't even gone through puberty going to experience in an environment that was most likely discriminatory and possibly viewed people with disabilities as asexual and not viable partners? Where would the essential social skills, flirting skills, and dating experience come from? As I said, professional sexual health services through the medical system provide an excellent educational and therapeutic environment, but cannot either promote or offer any kind of experiential service. I had met people that, because of desperation, sought connections through Craigslist and other back page advertising for escorts and that sort of thing. It was both male and female. Most of those connections proved to be unsatisfying and often exacerbated their feelings of isolation and hopelessness, and sometimes led to abuse. It seemed to me and a few others that providing a safe alternative with what I will call intimacy coaches that are trained about disability and sensitive to alternative forms of pleasure would be a great alternative. And a safe one. As well, we thought it extremely important to make sure people were connected to a peer support network whenever possible so that they could have open and honest discussions and hopefully not feel alone or unique in their needs. We started a group called EASE that stands for Equitable and Accessible Sexual Expression. Our approach has three main ideas. Firstly, to raise awareness and understanding about disability and sexuality by hosting film screenings, webinars, discussion groups, peer networks, and that sort of thing. Secondly, to advocate for changes in legal frameworks and to promote and provide training and orientation to both sex workers and people with disabilities. And third, to facilitate access to direct experiential services for people with disabilities. We also work with professional sexual health therapists and have collaborated with other groups such as the Pivot Legal Society, the Disability Foundation, and Spinal Cord Injury BC. In our consultations with current and former sex workers, I must say that my impression of what sex work and sex workers was completely turned upside down. I mean, they were so enthusiastic, compassionate, and caring, and wanting to really serve their clients well. I think I went into this I had never, seen an escort before. I'd never paid for sex. I had this issue about it. Why would you want to pay for it? There was something wrong. And prostitution was something that took place in the back alleys of the downtown East Side, and it was dirty and dangerous. And, well, there is a small element that is that, unfortunately. People that are addicted and are forced into certain behaviors and that kind of thing. But everybody that I've met has been so full of compassion and caring and big-heartedness and sensitivity that I really view it as a form of therapy, not as a release. So in a lot of these, in that case, they were mainly women, had seen clients with disabilities and didn't really know what to do, hadn't been oriented to their disability, and felt that they had failed their clients. So they were very keen to get involved. So, to walk the talk, I thought I had to have these experiences myself. I had to, go out and see what was currently available. I went to a few escort massage parlors, tantric workers. And I had experience, in sexuality before disability and after. And I was extremely nervous. I would drive around the block. I'd sit in my van for an hour kind of contemplating what was going to happen. I didn't know whether I'd be accepted. I didn't know how to negotiate. I thought I'd be rejected. And I'm thinking, well, what about all the people that don't have experience? Does that not say that it's even going to be that much harder for them? Plus, you don't know the place you're going or the person you're calling is understanding about your particular needs. So it's just going to reinforce this idea, and maybe it is a radically inclusive idea, about sex and disability. That is reasonable, and we think it is, to have a service that is safe, is informed, people are educated, they meet each other, and they can have, and like I said, sex is not only intercourse. That's not what everybody's looking for. Sometimes it's just a matter of sensitive, intimate touch, cuddling with someone, but having some sort of comfort level with that kind of intimacy. And we're just trying to sort of bridge that gap for people. I mean, it's a small, we don't actually provide the service. We have connections that we can make referrals to. And I get emails through our website and Facebook that it's heartbreaking, really. There's so many people that are reaching out. And there really aren't services. It's a network that we're trying to build. There's plenty of people in the States. I mean, there's the International Surrogacy Association. It's kind of a legal gray area. And some people that I met recently at the International Mind-Body Therapy Institute, looking at different forms of therapy. And sometimes the touch is only one way. It's not always an interactive experience. But it might be, say, for someone like myself that has suddenly lost all their sensation, if I could work with somebody to do what might be called body mapping, to try to figure out if I, you know, can find a pleasurable way of in having another, you know, positive sexual experience. So that's basically what we're doing, and it's I think those other areas that I talked about, very important to have the peer support. Because, I mean, we have people that, we don't really only deal with physical disabilities, and there's a lot of people reaching out that have very complex issues through head injuries and mental health problems and behavioral issues, developmental issues that are a little more complex, and the training, but we're getting involved in training and we're developing training with options for sexual health. So things are actually moving in the right direction and we're starting to establish those networks. And I might just add that, I mean, the community of people with disabilities is not entirely always supportive of this idea, because sometimes people tend to think that it reinforces old mythologies about disability, that people with disabilities need help in every aspect of their life. And I get that part. We're just saying that we notice there are people that could benefit from this and do benefit from this. And we've chosen to take some steps to support them. My timer went out. How are we? All right, I'll just... It's noon. What happened? Well, in very general terms, inclusion, and this is my friend Alfia Batalova. We actually had a conversation. She's doing her PhD in disability studies, so I've been getting bits and pieces of this talk from a lot of friends of mine that are throwing ideas at me. So in very general terms, inclusion entails being accepted as an individual beyond disability, having a sense of belonging, experiencing a valued social role, being trusted within one's community, and having significant and reciprocal relationships. Purposes behind inclusion can be individual or collective. Individual aims include increasing confidence, happiness, and well-being, whereas collective purposes include combating societal patterns of poverty, unemployment, discrimination, stigma, and abuse. The idea behind radicalizing inclusion is about politicizing the term that is often taken for granted, used sparingly and defined narrowly. Meanwhile, inclusion has as much to do with building a ramp as with addressing the connection between poverty and disability. Recognizing the diversity within disability community and the existing structural injustices that leave a lot of people excluded. We need to go beyond the institutionalized inclusion and mere presence of diversity in the room that is now being associated with inclusion. A more meaningful and honest discussion that doesn't simplify inclusion or make it about the charity-based, condescending look at disability is needed. If inclusion is just about physical appearance or physical presence and visibility, what we have is an illusion of inclusion. Maybe just a couple of quotes before we end. How about we do that? Is that from Rudolf Steiner? Somehow I ran across Rudolf Steiner. He seemed to have a lot of interesting things to say that fit. But these are kind of our basic where we want to be. Love starts when we push aside our ego and make room for someone else. Love is higher than opinion. If people love one another, the most varied opinions can be reconciled. Thus, one of the most important tasks for humankind today and in the future is that we should learn to live together and understand one another. If this human fellowship is not achieved, all talk of development is empty. Once again, thank you very much, particularly to Jean and Joan and Deborah. It's been a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. Oh, and there's some references that will be on the website, right? Yeah. So I've just some readings. It's not all about sex and disability, but there's some articles that I had read kind of looking into this issue of radical inclusion, and some books that I've read that just, from my point of view, are just another way of recognizing there's other things going on biologically and you know, in systems-based, physiologically, and in our forests, that just opened my eyes to a whole new reality of things that, and other ways of looking at things. So that's, I find that very stimulating. Hopefully you'll get something good out of these references that are left for you. All right. Thank you.